cash, every movie costs $2,184.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Backtracks Theme Music. My name is Corey Morissette, joined as always by John Mariano. And John, what's your favorite school subject?
Oh, it's poetry.
Really? Well, maybe you can help me straighten out my Longfellow. That's right, we're talking about the Rodney Dangerfield classic, Back to School, here today. John, I know this is a favorite of yours as well. Even though it's my choice, I didn't have to twist your arm too much to cover this one today.
Well, not to derail the show too much early. And as much as I enjoy the literature teacher and Rodney Dangerfield's Thornton Mellon's relationship in this movie, the reason why I love poetry, do you know this? Is I believe it's Police Academy 3. And Zed, played by Bobcat Goldthwait, is trying to romance one of the female characters in that movie with a poem. I remember that poem verbatim. Would you like to hear that poem, Corey?
Yes, please.
Jean Jean made a machine. JoJo made it go. Art laid a fart and blew the whole damn thing apart. And you got to picture Bobcat Goldthwait delivering that. It is perfection.
I believe that was Police Academy 4, though, wasn't it?
Oh, it might have been. What I know, this is a Police Academy show. This is a Back to School show. Well, take me back to school and teach me about the police academies.
You know, he's in both of those, so I really don't know who's right. I haven't seen those movies in forever, but yeah, we're not doing Police Academy. We're doing Back to School. God, I had a lot of fun. This is about as 80s a movie as you can get. Some absolutely classic Rodney Dangerfield lines, like the football team at my high school, they were tough. After they sacked the quarterback, they went after his family.
Yeah. His Thornton Mellon in this, he's big and tall or big and fat?
Tall and fat, wasn't it?
Oh, is it tall and fat?
It's some combination of those.
Yeah, and it's so brilliant because so many jokes come out of that. Hey, you're tall and fat. Well, you're short and stupid, or whatever his comebacks are.
Yeah.
You know, this is a movie built around Rodney to give him some of the best one-liners that only he deserves.
Oh, and some great ones, like, I think I'm attracted to teachers. Yeah, I took out an English teacher. That didn't work out at all. I sent her a love letter. She corrected it.
And the supporting cast in this, you know, cannot be underscored enough. Sally Kellerman has such great chemistry with Rodney. As Dr. Diane Turner, the literature teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is our second Keith Gordon movie in what, 2 or 3 weeks now?
Yeah.
And my favorite bully of the 80s,
yes,
makes an appearance in here.
Adrienne Barbeau as Rodney Dangerfield's second wife. No, of course you're talking about William Zabka. I read a funny thing about him, I guess. He was afraid he was getting typecast as bully, so he tried to make his character a lot more like humorous and entertaining. And the director's like, no, just do what you did in Karate Kid. We're not looking for what you're doing.
Which stinks, because he's such a good actor.
Mm-hmm.
But his presence as the bully in this, and like picking on Mellon, and like he's like the super tough diver, right? Like... You know, he's the diving team captain, and that's what makes him the big bully in this. It's kind of amazing. Like, dude, you're on the diving team. Relax.
Yeah.
And I'm not picking on people on the diving team, but maybe don't bully people if you're wearing a Speedo.
Exactly. And did you know that Rodney Dangerfield was actually a competitive diver in his younger days? And the story he tells to M. Emmett Walsh in the movie about, you know, diving in school and there was a diving horse and all that, that was all real.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, he was a competitive swimmer and diver back in his younger days. So,
was the Triple Lindy real too?
No, that was not real. That was invented for the movie. But still, one of the most legendary aspects of Back to School is the Triple Lindy.
I used to tell my mom I wanted to do that. She's like, "Yeah, you'll break your neck."
I think anybody would. Like, it's It's quite the thing. If you haven't seen Back to School, please rush out and do so and discover the brilliance of the triple Lindy.
So not only is this our second Keith Gordon movie, I believe it's our second William Zabka movie, but I'm pretty sure this is our second Burt Young movie.
Well, yeah, we did a Rocky movie, right? We did
Rocky Four.
Yeah.
We did Rocky Four, and then he shows up as Lou.
His bodyguard slash chauffeur driver.
I don't get mad. I get even. When I get mad, Lou gets upset.
Yeah.
But he crushes the napkin holder.
Yeah.
That's so good. And you got Emmett Walsh, Ned Beatty. My Lord, like this cast. And you know who I haven't mentioned yet? It's the big scene from this movie.
Okay.
Should I say his name? Or you do you want to say it? I think say it.
Oh,
say it.
Sounds like a comedian from the 80s who's quite loud and quite popular, but it goes by the name of Sam Kinison.
My Lord. That scene with him dumping on, I'm pretty sure it was the Vietnam War he's talking about, right?
Yep.
In that scene?
Yep.
And going into what it was like to fight in Vietnam, to rub it in Thornton Mellon's face, and then Rodney gives it right back to him. Are two comedic heavyweights, two stand-up comedian heavyweights that get screen time together, and it was an instant classic scene. Like everybody was talking about that scene the minute this movie came out.
Well, and if you watch carefully in that scene, Sam Kinison as Professor Turgeson is going off in the only way Sam Kinison can. And there's a shot of him from the back, and you can see the class, and Rodney Dangerfield is laughing, but he's kind of in the background. They had to leave that in because they couldn't do a take where Dangerfield wasn't just cracking up the entire time. So they left that one shot in where he's just kind of smiling and trying to stifle it. Because he was just so happy that Sam Kinison was doing that scene with him and was so hilarious. So there is a shot of Rodney Dangerfield breaking character and laughing at Sam Kinison in the movie.
I mean, I don't know how you could get through that scene without laughing.
Yeah.
Like I feel like every single time they film me, if I were eating it from Kinison in that scene, like I would break every single time.
Yeah, you're laughing throughout the whole thing anyway, because like Rodney Dangerfield is a comedic legend. You know, look at his work in Caddyshack, and then he gets his big starring vehicle here back in 1986. And man, just knocked it out of the park. It's just wall-to-wall jokes.
Now, there's a major actor I'm going to table to the end because we still have a couple of more people in this cast to get through.
Mm-hmm.
Because this cast is so deep. This roster is like it's like the 1927 Yankees. Like it just keeps going.
That's right.
Right. You have M. Emmett Walsh, great character actor. Mm-hmm. Ned Beatty, great character actor. Edie McClurg, incredible 80s presence and character actress.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You have a young Jason Hervey playing a young Thornton Mellon.
Yep.
Right. Jason Hervey, who is now a producer, but was originally on The Wonder Years playing the older brother and has gone on to become a great producer in his own right. Mm-hmm. I think he does a lot of reality TV shows now. And then I'm looking, somebody buried in this somewhere, and she must have a very small part. We're playing Laura Campbell. And I got to go back and rewatch the movie because you watched it recently, and you may not even have picked up on this, but there was a very young Leah Remini in this movie.
Yes, I remember seeing her. Definitely not a big part or anything for Leah Remini. But she's in this. I wanted to shout out one. I'm pretty sure I know the big name that you're going to be referencing later. The name of Paxton Whitehead. Nobody might know that name, but if you've seen a snooty British character in a movie, odds are it was played by Paxton Whitehead. And here he plays Professor Barbey, who's kind of Thornton Mellon's kind of foil in the school. And God, he's just so fucking good at playing a British asshole.
Yeah, he's perfection in this role, and I've seen him in other things. He's usually that guy from that thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like you know, that's what you know him as. But he's utter perfection playing the dick and the foil in this movie to Rodney and preventing him from passing this class.
Yep. And my favorite part with him was Thornton Mellon had to write a paper on Kurt Vonnegut. So he actually hired Kurt Vonnegut to write the paper. And then he submitted it, and Professor Barbe said, whoever wrote this paper, I know it wasn't you. Whoever wrote it doesn't know the first thing about Kurt Vonnegut. So the third mill is on the phone with Kurt Vonnegut, like, you son of a bitch.
Yeah, tearing apart. And they actually put Vonnegut in the movie, which is great. Beyond that, like you mentioned, Adrienne Barbeau, who is always fantastic. Mm-hmm. She has a small but important role, because she's what helps spur Rodney to go back to school. Terry Farrell, who would go on to Star Trek fame, mm-hmm. plays the love interest. You know what? I will drop one more. And you've seen him in a few things, is Robert Picardo, and he's in some Star Trek. He's a great character actor. I believe he's in Gremlins 2, The New Batch as well.
He is, yeah. He's also in Inner Space, which is a movie we're going to be covering on here very soon, because I want to do Twist the Night Away. And he played the Doctor in Star Trek Voyager, whereas Terry Farrell played a character on Deep Space Nine, if I remember correctly.
Yep. Yeah, so that covers almost everybody. Was there anybody, you know what? Give me an obscure or a lesser known movie that the actor we haven't mentioned yet is from.
An obscure or lesser known movie. All right. Well, we covered one. Did we not?
Have we covered one of his movies yet?
I think we might have.
Oh, I think you're right. It's not that obscure, but you can go with that one.
He was in a movie called Up the Academy. He was also in Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And the year before this one, he had a role in Weird Science,
which is a movie we will be covering soon.
And probably with this band, actually, maybe.
and he also starred as Charlie Chaplin.
Yep. Well, that's not quite obscure. I think he gave it away now. He was part of the Saturday Night Live cast, though, while he was doing Back to School.
Oh, he was. And some people, when he was on Ally McBeal, thought he was less than zero.
Right. Johnny B. Good.
I happen to think that this guy and his acting talent is a real Iron Man.
Any guesses out there? Anyone? It doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure this one out, folks. You want to say it?
It's what I used to think was Morton Downey Jr.'s son. Because as a child, I thought Jr. was a last name. So I figured Downey Jr. and Downey Jr. were the same. You know what? Morton Downey Jr.'s son is not Robert Downey Jr.
What? I'm shocked. That's hilarious. I had no idea that you thought it. It makes sense, though.
Oh, as a child, I was slightly dumber than I am now.
Well, let's maybe talk about the song we're covering here tonight, which everybody knows who clicked on the link, but we're going to talk a little Oingo Boingo, or as they were known originally, the Mystic Knights of the Oingo Boingo, led by Danny Elfman, who actually composed the score for Back to School as well. So not only did he do the score, not only did his band contribute a song, they're in the movie too, playing this song at one of Thornton Mellon's parties. So you can't really talk about an 80s comedy without talking about Oingo Boingo. They had songs in Bachelor Party, Weird Science that we already mentioned, and of course this one here, Back to School, back in 86. Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, like pretty much every Tim Burton movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's prolific.
No kidding. So we're talking about the song Dead Man's Party, which is the song that Oingo Boingo is playing at Thornton Mellon's party. It's from their album of the same name. This was the third single. It was released April 1986. And what do you say? Should we just get into it, John? Or do you got anything?
Yeah. I just want to point out that this was the second score Danny Elfman did.
Okay.
You had mentioned Pee-wee's Big Adventure. I believe these movies came out the same year, but that was the first score, and this was the second score he did. So he was just moving into, he's transitioning from being the front man of Oingo Boingo into full on. Everything he does from here is like music scores.
Right. And some big ones too, like Batman 89 and a ton of, I think he just did Doctor Strange in the
Multiverse of
Madness. Yeah.
Yeah.
ton of great scores. But here's a little Danny Elfman from way back in the early 80s and his band Oingo Boingo. Here's a little Dead Man's Party.
I'm all dressed up with nowhere to go. Walking with a dead man on my shoulder. I'm all dressed up with nowhere to go. Walking with a dead man over my shoulder.
All right, John, what do you think so far?
I think it's fantastic. This is what, exactly what I want to hear out of an 80s sound. Like, I would love to say I would have loved to have heard Oingo Boingo continue, because I do love their work. And when we get to Weird Science, we'll hear that as well. Mm-hmm. But his like scoring career can't be understated. He's one of the greatest movie composers of all time.
So
it's like, as great as this sound is, I feel like some of the elements, now I know it's much darker and creepier, the sounds of his songs, or of his scores, but I feel like that ability to sound different is evident in Oingo Boingo.
Yeah, very much so. Exotic percussion kind of sound to it. You had some new wave kind of going through there. Got a horn section, a little bit of everything in this, but it takes me right back to the 80s in my red jacket with the multiple zippers and really bad hair and acid wash jeans and all that kind of fun stuff. If you want bad hair, watch Robert Downey Jr. In the movie. He plays a very weird character who's like Keith Gordon's only friend, Thornton Mellon's son.
He actually drops to the floor on his back in this scene and yells, "Do me, do me, do me," as holding his inner thighs with his hands.
Yes, that's future Academy Award nominee Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, but he's very funny playing the weird, quirky friend in this movie, which is very, when you look at him, it's very odd casting overall, because we think of him as a leading man, and not as the best friend. But he does, because he also plays the best friend bully in Weird Science. Like, he's not even the main mm-hmm. bully; he's the best friend bully.
That's right. So
it was like the sidekick in that movie, because he's shorter. So Corey, I really like this sound, but I keep going back to the movie because I'm so hung up on the movie. And one of the things I'm caught up on, like, it's such a quotable movie. One of my favorite things is, it's like every single time Rodney, I think he did this in Caddyshack too, feels like he gets the last line in, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when he's exchanging with his son, Jason, and Jason's telling him classes are 11, and he's like, "All right, I'll show up at 11, but I'm gonna talk to that dean though." Like, as if everything can be negotiated with his business sense, right? Your football line that you said earlier. Do you have any favorite lines from this?
Oh, too many. There's a whole bunch that I enjoyed, being a portly gentleman at the beginning when he's doing his commercial. You know, when you go to the zoo, do the elephants throw you peanuts? When you're making love, do you have to give directions? I always enjoyed a good fat joke.
My favorite joke in the commercial is, so take it from me, Thornton Mellon, if you want to look thin, you hang out with fat people.
Yeah. it's actually his business prowess that earns him the wrath of Philip Barbey, the dean of the business school. And as he's teaching his class, and Ronnie Dangerfield's like, no, you don't do that. Like, that's dumb. Your overhead's too much.
Wait, you got to buy off the Teamsters. And he's giving you, like, all the actual. Like,
yeah.
No, this is, if you want to do business, this is how you do business.
Yeah. You got to pay off the building inspectors. You got to pay off the Teamsters.
Yeah. And he's like, that's not what those business practices aren't what we teach here. And what is it, business ethics or whatever?
Yeah.
He's like, well, your business is going to go over under in like 5 months. Yeah. Right. Well, what do we make here? It's like fidget widgets or whatever he says, right?
Yeah.
It's just like, it's such a well done movie. And they don't do comedies like this anymore where like, it's so layered because it's satirizing like business, like small businessmen and how they do business. Mm-hmm. It's satirizing the entire education system, right? It's satirizing organized amateur sports. It's got all of these different layers and all of these things going on. And it's not just simply, here's the next set piece, kind of like what we do now, right? It's very much, everything is important and intertwined throughout this movie. And to the point where you get to that, you know, they build up Kinnison's character so much before you meet him, that he's such a terror, that when you see him tearing out students and then he tears out Rodney, and then Rodney calls Truman a pussy wimp, or whatever he calls him.
I think.
And he feeds it right back to him. Right. And Kinnison said, it's the first time the students see Kinnison back then. He's like, good answer. I'm going to keep my eye on you. Like, he gains his respect by yelling back at him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so many great things. Ned Beatty playing the dean, who is happy as long as he's getting his money from Rodney.
Yeah, because Rodney's building a new building for the business department, I believe. So the Thornton Mellon. I can't remember what the heck it's called, but he can do no wrong as long as the check clears.
Right. When Rodney suggests like the decathlon or whatever he does at the end, which they kind of poach in Billy Madison when they do Billy Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Phillip's like, are you really going to let him do this? He's like, the check cleared.
Yeah. And you buy it. Like you said, there's a lot of subtext. Everything kind of makes sense. And I just want to shout out the writers. You're going to recognize one of them. And when you talk about this being a smart script, when I say the last name, I think it'll make a lot of sense. But this is written by Steve Kampman, Will Porter, Peter Torkaway, and one Harold Ramis, one of my favorite all-time movie writers. And, of course, he wrote on SCTV and, so many director of Groundhog Day, did Stripes with Bill Murray. Ghostbusters, absolute legend, Harold Ramis, also co-wrote this screenplay.
Yeah. If there was a major comedy in the 80s, and I'm not saying every comedy, but there's a very good chance Harold Ramis had a hand in it at some point. He was a very underrated writer. And it's kind of like Carrie Fisher was a very underrated writer because most of her writing was ghostwriting on other screenplays.
Right.
Including helping out with the screenplay for When Harry Met Sally. She very quietly supported a lot of the stuff. Harold Ramis, his hands touched a lot of the stuff. He didn't always get the credit for it because he was touching it and not like the way they do the credits and whatnot. But he may have ended up with a special thanks in the movie or whatever. But he was influencing stuff. The stories came out after he sadly passed way too early.
Mm-hmm.
Of his influence over Hollywood comedy, especially in this time period, and I'm so grateful. Like, I used to look at it like Bill Murray was the funny Ghostbuster, and the more I've learned about it, while Murray does his improvising and vamping that make it great, all four of them throughout Hollywood have done things. and like Dan Aykroyd's like the comedian's comedian, like he makes other comedians laugh, and Harold Ramis, you know, influencing a Rodney Dangerfield movie, who, like, if you think about anybody who doesn't need writing, right? And the connection here is, right, of course Ramis would be involved in this because he was involved in Caddyshack.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So and that was Rodney. If you ever see the interviews with Rodney talking about Caddyshack, how nervous he was, and people have talked about it, about Rodney, that he was uncomfortable because nobody was laughing at the jokes. And he said, the movie's not funny. And I think Harold explained to him, if people laugh at the jokes, you ruin the take. Because he was used to the live audience from stand-up comedy.
Right. Definitely a different mindset. You mentioned a light touch on a screenplay, reminiscent of Lou giving Thornton Millen a massage.
Oh, he
has magic fingers.
Burt Young is one of the most underrated character actors in movie history. I know this isn't that far of a cry from you know what he does in Rocky and what he does in other films,
mm-hmm.
but what his presence adds. He's not the largest man in the room, but you don't doubt when Dangerfield calls him the toughest man in the room. You don't doubt it at all.
Yep.
You know, he was the Joe Pesci, I think, before there was a Joe Pesci.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. I'd agree with that. This is a very long song. Let's play a little bit more of it, shall we?
So I just want to musically point out a couple of things. First of all, it's sad that Elfman doesn't sing more because his voice is outstanding.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
One of the other things is the guitar riff in here, to me, to tie it into Elfman's scoring ability, feels a little Munster-esque, where, you know, from the Munsters, like that theme song. It almost feels like they're playing the guitar, the notes backwards. Right? Like it has this creepier kind of feel that gives it this off and spooky vibe that you would get in an Elfman song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you picking up on that?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And I'm just looking at the producers on this track because I was really digging the song and the style of it, the sound and the style. Produced by Danny Elfman and Steve Bartek, who was the guitar player for Oingo Boingo at the time. So it was self-produced. And it definitely has those Danny Elfman-isms in there. Lyrically, nothing too spectacular, right? I'm all dressed up with nowhere to go, walking with a dead man on my shoulder. They just kind of repeat that quite a few times, but maybe less about the lyrics. Although there is a lyric coming up I always attributed to Back to School. It turns out it had nothing to do with Back to School. Let's just play a little bit of it here. I heard that in the context of the movie, a chauffeur coming to my door. I thought he was talking about Lou. Oh, he tied in the whole the Lou angle into the film. Turns out that was based more on a short story called The Bus Conductor about a hearse driver. I had to look that up. I had no idea about that. But
you're right. It works for the movie as well. And I just love that this song, it's a dead man's party, right? It's really fitting for the vibe of the dorm or like the bar that they're at, where it's like not the popular kids in school. It's almost like this is where the weirdos and the freaks and the people I would hang out with hang out.
Mm-hmm. we talked about how this song fits the movie perfect. I'm looking at track listing and some of the other songs we could have chosen from this film. One I thought originally we were going to do would be Rodney Dangerfield singing Twist and Shout, you know, which he does in one of the party bar scenes.
You know what? It would have been a good call, but I would have put the kibosh on it because there's a possibly another movie that was released around the same time.
By John Hughes, maybe?
By John Hughes, maybe, with a parade scene where we might be covering Twist and Shout.
Right. She's having a baby. So, yeah, we'll save that one for that. But there was another track that I was kind of surprised, a glam hair metal song from this movie called Everybody's Crazy. Do you know who did that song, John?
Everybody's Crazy, a glam?
Yeah.
Are you saying a glam metal band?
Hard rock glam metal song.
Oof.
Bruce Kulick played guitar. Bruce Kulick from Kiss fame plays lead guitar on this track. Who's the singer?
I don't know. Where's Bruce Kulick from?
Kiss. Predominantly, he's been a great guitar player, session musician for
sorry, time. I only know Ace from Kiss, and he has issues with them.
Yeah, a little bit.
I don't know. I'm trying to go who the supergroups are. I always feel like Damn Yankees is one of my favorite supergroups, but it's too early for them.
It is. And to think more, he's more known for adult contemporary music, not hair metal. But his first couple of albums, or his first four anyway, were glam rock hair metal albums.
Please tell me you're talking about Michael Bolton.
Michael fucking Bolton.
Oh my Lord. Like, I didn't look it up either. It was just like, once you gave the description of adult contemporary, I'm like, I know, based on his hair and his look, who I hope this is.
Yeah.
And like, I was going to guess, like, Dawkins, but I don't know what the song you're talking about. So I was just going to guess random people. So you're telling me that Michael fucking Bolton was in a glam metal band?
Well, he was a glam metal artist. Yeah, this is from the same album called Everybody's Crazy. Like I said, Bruce Kulick plays on this. God, we may have to play a little bit of this before we call it a day. I knew when I said adult contemporary, you'd guess Michael Bolton or probably Harry Connick Jr. or kind of the two to come to mind. But there's a great picture of Michael Bolton. I'll move this over so you can see it. Check out that hair.
Oh, I can. Okay, so his hair was darker. He dressed. So if you can picture Michael Bolton, I'm going to give the description for the listeners right now. You can look up the album Everybody's Crazy, right? But he is wearing what can best be described as a red blouse pirate shirt.
Yep.
And on top of that, he has what I would call I almost want to call it like a pirate jacket, but like a fancy pirate. Not like a Captain Jack Sparrow, but like with a fancy pirate, like if you saw that Taika Waititi show last year, what they might be wearing on that show,
right?
It's a bunched up. I want to call it. It's not quite vinyl. It's like a faux leather jacket he's wearing.
It matches his patent fake leather pants.
Yeah, he has one of the large '80s belt buckles you might see on the Bengals.
It looks like a giant shower curtain ring.
Yeah, it really does, holding either end of that giant leather belt together. His hair is very Michael Bolton hair, but more permed out and darker. It's like not quite black, but it's a very deep brown. It's Michael Bolton's face on this body. And the sleeves are pulled up over, so that way his entire forearm is showing. And they're all bunched up, and it's a look. It's a look.
It's absolutely.
And he's wearing not jeans, because this is the '80s. You know what he's wearing, Corey?
Leather pants. What are they called?
No, those aren't leather pants. Those are jeans, but it's the '80s. You know what jeans were called in the '80s?
Chinos.
Dungarees.
Dungarees. Those aren't jeans. Those are leather, dude.
He's wearing dungarees.
No, those are fake pleather pants.
Okay, well, everyone now has to go and tweet at us and look this up and let us know if that's leather. I'm admittedly not wearing my glasses right now because the album is blue. Those look like dungarees to me. So tweet at us either dungarees or pleather.
You know what? Better yet, tweet at Michael Bolton and ask him what he was wearing on the cover of Everybody's Crazy. I'm sure he'd love to hear from you. I gotta tell you that that bass was super funky. I dug that, but the synthesizer kind of lost me a little bit.
Yeah, but it's the sound of the band. It's the sound of the time, right? Yeah. Like while it might lose you, keep in mind the whole song isn't played in the movie, and you gotta put yourself in an '80s club. Would you be doing the white man's overbite to this song? Yeah, probably.
Oh, I'm doing that now. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So the synthesizers really bring that out in you. So I can't fault the synthesizers in this song. That's part of the sound of the time.
That's very true. This is very much an 80s song, very much an 80s band. That's why, they made it to what, 1995, I think was the last time that they were really active, Oingo Boingo. Their last album came out in 94 called Boingo. I know that some of the other members of Oingo Boingo tried to break off and do their own thing. Johnny Vatos had a project called Johnny Vatos Oingo Boingo Dance Party, and then they renamed that to Oingo Boingo Former Members, which is catchy as hell.
So I want to bring this back to the movie for a minute. I want to ask you a question, because we're getting towards the end of the song. So I want to get a little bit towards the end of the movie. When the coach of the diving team recognizes Thornton Mellon as the guy who used to do the triple Lindy at the show on Coney Island. Okay. As a Canadian, what are the images that you have in your head of a young Thornton Mellon doing that trick on Coney Island? Can you kind of put me there? Say you're in the crowd, describe the atmosphere, describe what you see. And I'll tell you, as a kid from New York, what I imagined.
Okay. Well, I always kind of pictured Coney Island as being a kind of, you know, everything is kind of made of wood. It's rickety. It's always kind of overcast and gray looking. I don't know how to describe it any better. But it's like a really shitty amusement park where the roller coaster is made out of wood. And, you know, you have basically just a giant barrel of water and people are diving into it. And there's a diving horse at some point, because they mentioned that in the movie too at Coney Island. But Coney Island, yeah, I think about bad food. Hot dogs, corn dogs, that kind of thing. Really old, rickety type rides that I wouldn't go on, and always being very gray and gloomy.
Have you ever been to Coney Island?
No, of course not. Not even close. I don't even think I've seen a real picture of it. Was that where they went in the movie The Wrestler?
I think so.
Yeah, because that was very gray and overcast, and that kind of reaffirmed my belief.
And you see parts of it in Cloverfield as well.
Okay.
I can tell you, my mother and I was a child, and my mother and I got into a discussion about this. Because when I heard that he was diving in Coney Island, my reaction as a child was, that's gross. And my mother was like, well, that used to be the place to go. Like, it used to be, if you can imagine, it was very similar to, like, what you see in Jaws. Right? Like, that's very much what Coney Island beaches were like in the 50s, or when he would have been doing this, right? But I pictured Coney Island of the 80s that I had been to, which was kind of like what Corey described, with one small detail that I pictured very different. That the pool of water that Rodney was diving into was also very gray, greenish, right? Like, I just, because when I picture Coney Island, I don't mean to shit on an entire part of my hometown, but I picture dirty and dingy, including the water. And my guttural reaction as a child was, oh, that's gross, right? Because I picture Rodney all the way up on these diving boards doing this awesome diving trick, bouncing from board to board and going into the dingiest, grayest, like it's got a grayish crust on top of green water is, I think, what I imagined as a child.
Okay, well, that would make sense if the horse is diving into it, like they have parasites and shit. So yeah, I actually wasn't far off. I find that kind of cool. I can't picture it like the beach in Jaws because that was sunny.
Yeah, but that's in its heyday when Coney Island became a thing. That was kind of why it became a thing. Now, I will defend the shitty food. It is shitty food, but it's the shitty food you go after. Like the Coney Island corn dog, it's terrible for you, right? Mm-hmm. Like your doctor will hate you for years after you eat one. And your body will hate you for decades after you eat one. But it is one of the most delicious things you can eat.
I got that on my bucket list that if I ever make my way out to Long Island, will you take me out to Coney Island?
I might. We got a couple of places we got to stop. I'll give you the real tour of the area.
Excellent. Can't wait.
Walking down the street, I was hit by something last night.
All right, Dead Man's Party from Oingo Boingo. John, let's get back to school here. I always kind of like asking this about the films we cover on here. What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes score is for Back to School?
I mean, one, I don't give a shit because all go fuck themselves. also, Dan Merle, if anybody follows Dan Merle and wants to cross-reference Dan Merle with like Rotten Tomatoes or how they aggregate Rotten Tomatoes, he has an incredible video to show you why that score isn't as important as you think. But beyond that, I'll get off my soapbox for a minute and I'll play your little game, little man. And I will go with critics generally are harsher, and especially back then were harsher on comedies. This movie deserves no lower than an 89 in my mind, but probably scores closer to a 53.
Well, first of all, fuck you. Second of all, 86 is the Rotten Tomato score. So pretty close to your 89, actually.
I said no lower than 89. So Rotten Tomatoes is still wrong.
There you go. Roger Ebert had a great review. Three-word review. Routine, but pleasant.
I mean, that's fairly unextraordinary.
Yeah, a couple little trivia bits for you. The producers of the film wanted a certain comedian to play Professor Turgeson before the part went to Sam Kinison. Do you know that comedian?
Like stand-up comedian?
Yeah, he did some stand-up at that time.
Richard Belzer.
No, actually, Jim Carrey.
Oh.
But he was directed because he was way too young for the part.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was very young at that point.
Yeah, this is even before like Living Color or anything like that.
But he was playing in Rodney's club, so that probably makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The other thing I have for you here is this movie was a huge box office hit in 1986. It grossed $91 million, which doesn't sound like a lot in today's dollars, but back then that was a colossal hit off an $11 million budget. But it was the second highest grossing comedy of 1986. Do you know the first?
86?
Yep.
So 86 would have been the same year as Stand By Me, but that's not a comedy. Was it Inner Space also this year?
I think that was 80 or 85, I believe.
Is that Inner Space?
87. Nope.
Sticking with Inner Space, though, was this the same year as my three favorite Amigos?
I don't think so.
Oh, so it's not that.
No.
86.
It's a tricky one.
Can you give me multiple choice?
Can I give you multiple choice? Let me see. I'll try and find some other films from 86 here. Talk amongst yourselves as I look that up.
I'm going to look up 1986 movies. I hate when you give me like this trivia. You know I retired from this stuff, right, man?
Yeah, I know. But highest grossing comedies, 1986. Here's your multiple choice. Karate Kid Part 2, Crocodile Dundee, and The Golden Child.
Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, sorry, Karate Kid Part 2, Crocodile Dundee, and The Golden Child.
How is Karate Kid Part 2 a comedy?
It was either that or Aliens.
Really? You could have got Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Short Circuit, and Howard the Duck were all released this year. Little Shop of Horrors was released this year.
I'm not looking at that list. I'm looking at a worse list.
I'm just letting you know, those are all comedies. I gotta go. You know what? Eddie Murphy was on a roll. I'm going to go with Golden Child.
You're close. That's actually the third highest grossing comedy of that year, with $79 million. Number one was Crocodile Dundee, $174 million.
Well, that ain't a knife. This is a knife.
No kidding.
I mean, I've seen all of those movies, so it doesn't surprise me. To put a bow on this, I have one question for you. It's not a trivia question. It's just a personal question. Corey, one thing that has always escaped me from this movie, my brother became an expert of it after this movie. Were you ever master of the arm fart?
I wouldn't say master, I certainly made quite a few attempts.
Yeah, I've made plenty of attempts, but they're epic failures. Like, I could never get my hand in the right position in the pit to squeeze the air out that way.
Yeah, it's definitely not as easy as it seems. All right, John, I found a little something here. Let's just play a little bit of this.
Michael, are you crazy? I can't believe what you're wearing, what you look like. In high school, you looked so normal. I thought you were going to be a doctor or a lawyer or something normal like that.
Normal, huh?
Normal. This video is great. Look at his outfit there.
Everybody's crazy.
He's wearing like a bone necklace.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's crazy. We should have done this.
But this is your fault. This is your call today.
Look, there's Bruce Kulick, big hair drummer. Bolton written on the drum hit.
It sounds just like Michael Bolton, though.
Leather pants.
Corey's right. I was wrong. It's not dungarees. It's leather pants.
I just want to get to the chorus. Oh, that's good shit.
Yeah, it's good shit. Like, I get why he pivoted his career. Like the band's okay. Like he's still Michael Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a killer career on the adult contemporary charts. Like I'm fine with the career pivot. I don't know how you feel about that.
I'm a big fan of glam. So I kind of wish Michael Bolton would have kept releasing songs like this. I would have been right there.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about with glam who he was competing against. And I don't feel like I feel like this is C tier. I don't even think this is B tier of glam. Really? Yeah.
So compared to like, who do I put in the B tier? Bands like Britney Fox, Kix.
Yeah.
You know, White Winger? Lion. Winger? Well, Winger's borderline. Yeah, B-A.
No. If you're going to put Winger anywhere, he's like B-C.
Come on. The second album is really good, actually, from Winger. Well, I should say there's some really good songs on it. It's not a tremendous album, but.
Okay. Did you just hear the mental gymnastics you did to defend them?
Well, I was thinking back because I just had that spinning on my record player a while ago. I'm like, yeah, there's a couple of songs that skip on there. But still, Kip Winger's a pretty talented individual.
I'm not picking on Winger the man. I'm picking on Winger the band.
You're picking on Winger the everything, the ideal, the... You're just anti-Winger, and I don't know why.
I'm anti a lot of things. It tracks with me.
But you're pro back to school. Let's continue to put a bow on this one, John. Where can the folks find you? What you got coming up? What do you want to plug here today?
I will plug Backtracks, Aerosmith Revisited. Scott Haskin, Corey, and myself are going through painstakingly every Aerosmith song ever released. There's been some great ones. There's been some stinkers. Seems like more people are enjoying the stinker episodes. But I recommend listening to all of them because they are fun to make. So join us there. Listen to us here. Find us everywhere.
There you go. And yes, you can find me a part of that show as well as and the podcast Will Rock with Mark Kammeyer breaking down the Van Halen catalog. All these shows and much, much more you can find on the Deep Dive Podcasting Network. But until next time, on behalf of John Mariano, my name is Corey Marcet. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you next time on Backtracks Theme Music.
Welcome to contemporary American history. I'm Professor Turgeson. You know, a lot of people think history is just facts. It's just information about the past, but not me. I mean, I hold history very sacred, sacred. The way the farmer looks at the earth and he holds it sacred. The way a Christian takes the Bible and he holds it sacred. The way a lot of people hold their marriage sacred. So I feel about it. So why don't we dive right in by interpreting one of the easiest events in the last 20 years of American history. Now, can someone tell me why in 1975 we pulled our troops out of Vietnam?
The failure of Vietnamization to win popular support caused an ongoing erosion of confidence in the various American but illegal Saigon regimes.
Is she right? Because I know that's the popular version of what went on there. And a lot of people like to believe that. I wish I could, but I was there. I wasn't here in a classroom, hoping I was right, thinking about it. I was up to my knees in rice paddies with guns and Edwards going up against Charlie, slugging it out with him, while pussies like you were back there partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle albums.
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you? I mean, these kids, they were in grade school at the time. And me, I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
Well, I didn't know you wanted to get involved with the discussion, Mr. Helper. But since you want to help, maybe you can help me, okay? You remember that thing we had about 30 years ago called that Korean conflict? Yeah, and where we failed to achieve victory. How come we didn't cross the 38th parallel and push those rice eaters back to the Great Wall of China and take the burnt brick and nuke them back into the fucking Stone Age River? How come? Tell me why! Say it! Say it!
All right, I'll say it. Because Truman was too much of a pussy wimp to let MacArthur go in there and blow out those commie bastards!
Good answer. Good answer. I like the way you think. I'm gonna be watching you.
Well, good teacher.
He really seems to care. About what, I have no idea.